This is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. My guest today is Amina Anand Kumar. She's the Director of Machine Learning at NVIDIA and Bren Professor at Caltech. Amina has led research in tensor algebraic methods, large-scale learning, deep learning, probabilistic models, and non-convex optimization, among others. She's the youngest named chair professor at Caltech, the highest honor bestowed to an individual faculty. She is part of the World Economic Forum's expert network, consisting of leaders in academia, business, government, and media. She's the recipient of several awards, including Alfred P. Sloan Fellowship, NSF Career Award, Young Investigator Award from the Air Force and Army Researchers Office, faculty fellowship from Microsoft, Google, Adobe, and several Best Paper Awards. Dr. Anand Kumar is also deeply passionate about democratizing AI and eliminating bias in the data we use to build systems, as well as the other subtle ways bias infiltrates research, device building, and industry. She is spearheading important research and groundbreaking in almost every way. She works in changing our model for AI and its impact on the world we live in. We had a chance to touch on most of these things, and I had a wonderful time doing it.
All right. Thank you so much, Anima, for coming on to talk to me today.
It's my pleasure. Great to be here.
I mean, you are one of the more fascinating people around. And I just, you know, I jump between watching technical lectures of yours at Caltech to watching things that are so engrossing to people who have no background in artificial intelligence at all. I fall somewhere in the middle, I guess, but probably more towards the layman in it. To get involved with such a thing that is both difficult, esoteric, but also at the same time, part of all of our lives, what made you get started in this?
Yeah, no, it's such an interesting time for AI. You know, the last few years has seen the field explode, and we've seen so many impressive gains in many benchmarks, and it's in the public interest. So it's a great time to be working in this field. But when I was growing up, you know, I had no idea that AI would take off like this, right? In fact, I wasn't even thinking of AI as the centerpiece per se, but more of the human mind itself. You know, I remember being fascinated. I think I was maybe three and a half. And I have this moment that I recall so vividly that I suddenly kind of started feeling like I have an identity, you know, like a self-actualization. And I'm sure, you know, every child goes through that. But for me, that moment, I still can remember and connect to that. And so this aspect of, you know, what kind of gets our human mind to get to that level of thinking and develop that identity has fascinated me since then. And then I went through, you know, maths and sciences. I've always loved the structure that math gave and the ability to model the world around us. But when I came to high school and I discovered probability and statistics, I was fascinated. You know, you cannot just think about determinism and the aspect that the world is in order, but also model the chaos and the disorder in the world. And that was fascinating, the ability of probability to reason about that, get a handle on that. And I think that to me is probably the starting point in my journey towards artificial intelligence, because without the foundation of probability, we cannot, you know, talk about learning. We cannot talk about learning from random data, being able to generate answers and ultimately lead to intelligence.
So I was speaking to somebody, Pamela McCordick, who has been around since the very beginning, you know, the famous Dartmouth meeting of AI research. We started to talk about sort of two different, maybe even three different schools of why people got involved with AI. And I find it really interesting what you pointed out, that there are those that kind of reverse engineer the brain, try to understand who we are. Then there's, you know, and maybe there's then the more mathematical, interested in like mathematical reduction. And then there are the more inventors in a sense of trying to create a new artificial intelligence. You have straddled all of those worlds, but it seems like working in academia and working in industry, but it seems interesting to me that what got you was trying to have this predictive quality. We can't predict who we are. If we understood our brains, could we? How can we create sort of a grand, you know, prediction machine? Is that still something that drives you on a regular basis?
Certainly does. You know, so complex, right? This dream to create an intelligent agent, perhaps as intelligent as us, thinking like us, but maybe ultimately feeling like us, you know, is one of the humanity's greatest dreams. But the question of, you know, how to turn that dream into concrete steps, right? We cannot always be enamored by the dream and forget the aspect of scientific methods, right? Meaning we have to have quantifiable ways to evaluate progress. And that's where, you know, benchmarks like ImageNet have been very powerful, right? The aspect that how well can we do in recognizing images, lots of categories of images, and you also have many millions of examples to learn from, you know, that's a definite benchmark, right? But then that's not the complete answer to our quest for intelligence, because indeed, you know, the inspiration we get from our own brains is also, you know, very critical. But our brain has different constraints. You know, it has only limited energy that it can work with, limited space it can work with. But it also has the advantage of millions, if not billions of years of evolution, right? The priors we have built up, the intuitions we have about the world around us, and that's, you know, that's almost impossible to engineer in our current artificial systems. And that's why I think we shouldn't be too constrained to be neuromorphic or be almost have the same mechanism as our brain does, but perhaps derive inspiration, right, of how our brain is so robust, is able to incorporate all kinds of changes in the environment. You know, it's able to do zero-shot generalization. For instance, a child who has never seen an elephant, even seeing it for the first time, would know it's an animal, right? But the current machine learning methods have challenges in overcoming those kind of challenges. And one of the recent works that we've been working on, I've been working with Doris Saul, who's a neuroscientist here at Caltech. And we've been, you know, having lots of interesting debates on what the human brain can do and what we can build in AI. And to me, a critical mechanism is feedback, right? So when you're seeing me or seeing the world around, you know, we don't immediately make an assumption of what's there in the image, right? Or what we are seeing. So perception involves not just the feed forward mechanism in the brain or the bottom up, but also the top down mechanism or the feedback. Yeah. And that's coming from the priors that we have, right? So that's coming from the internal model of the world. And that's something we've been now building into our current neural networks to also have these feedback mechanisms. So in this way, we can derive a lot of good inspiration from the human brain while not necessarily being constrained by the same kind of requirements or that our brain has.
Yeah, that's, I don't know why something that you said that should have been so obvious just struck me when you're speaking about priors. I always consider priors, especially if you're talking about something like a classifier or the sheer amount of data that is needed in order to have good classifiers, unless you have some type of robust priors into the system for sparse data, like you've worked in these areas. But I think of humans creating priors through experience or you know, having seen other people and understanding what it is. You mentioned priors as being evolutionarily built into us. Is there an equivalent in the space of creating or of you know, combining machine learning with some kind of, you know, inherent evolutionary.
Yeah, I mean, evolution has, you know, has created the world around us, but it's also taken us so long, right? So I don't think we necessarily want to replicate the same evolutionary process, although some researchers do explore those areas. But we can be much more targeted, right? For instance, you know, the way we train our neural networks with gradient descent or backpropagation is not following those principles, but then it's better, right? So that's what I mean by the aspect that we can derive inspiration, but we don't have to be constrained by the same aspects that, you know, we went through in evolution. And to me, the kind of aspect of, you know, what evolution gave us and also what just unsupervised learning gives us is a combination, right? So meaning an infant is born with certain priors, but they do get further enhanced through unsupervised learning. You know, in the first few years of an infant's life, it's mainly unsupervised learning, right? So the infant is observing the world around, trying to crawl, trying
making
to
make mistakes, succeeding in things.
That's right. That's right. And only later, right, somebody tells the child, oh, look, this is a cat, this is a dog. It doesn't have the labels when it is first observing a cat. And that it's the aspect of, you know, there are first rough priors and then they get further enhanced through unsupervised learning. And I think we can derive inspiration through those kind of mechanisms, right? For instance, in AI, we can have pre-trained models, you know, and we now do that in images, videos, language, and then we fine-tune it when we do want to enhance it for a specific task, right? I mean, right now, this is still way too primitive and simplistic. So ultimately, we would like a mechanism that would, you know, have some form of pre-training, right? Some prior knowledge could be an also in addition a knowledge base, other things it can look up. And then it rapidly learns and adapts online when new tasks are coming in, new domains are coming in.
Right. I mean, everything that you've spoken about so far, I would say, is on the algorithmic level and the almost the philosophical level, kind of the two sides, you know, algorithmic, you know, encompassing all the mathematics and probably the, you know, how it is actually, you know, implemented in code. But you're doing academic research at Caltech, you're well cited, well published. You're a true scientist, but your relationship with NVIDIA being, you know, I think that there was this sort of moment, maybe it was around 2015. You could probably tell me the year when NVIDIA's deep learning toolbox and, you know, we start using tensors, stuff like this that you were involved with became, you know, company like ours that does, you know, uses reinforcement learning in factories and do these. We couldn't have done it without this type of hardware architecture or some other type that didn't exist. Can you tell me how did you see the limitations of current hardware and did that drive you to have this type of partnership? And, you know, where do you think that it's going in hardware going forward?
Yeah. I think it's very fascinating. And for a lot of people, especially in the public, right, they don't, when they think of AI, they don't think of the hardware, right? They think of the algorithms, maybe data, because, you know, now there's a lot of emphasis on data, but not the hardware. But to me, it's this trinity that makes AI possible, right? Because the ideas around neural networks have been around since the 30s, if not earlier, you know, because it's a nice conceptual foundation in terms of, okay, we have many layers of processing, you know, we can learn features from data, right? But how to do this at scale? You know, if we have millions or billions of parameters in a model and we have even more number of computations involving those parameters, how do we do that in a reasonable scale? Right. And back in the 80s, there was a lot of excitement around neural networks, but the computational frameworks at that time wasn't good enough, right? And that's why there was the AI winter, and people kind of, you know, felt disillusioned about neural networks. But what worked in this past decade is the synergy of data algorithms and compute infrastructure coming together. You know, we have now the web scale data available, right? The ImageNet was possible only because the internet is out there and we could scrape images at scale. I mean, now there are ethical issues with doing that. That's a different story. We can get into that later. But that did enable this current revolution. And then the GPUs are having the parallelism that was not present in the earlier generation of hardware, right? Because single-threaded programming has, single-threaded computing rather, has plateaued. You know, we no longer have the Moore's law. It's not growing exponentially. And the only way we can keep up with all the compute needs and the needs of AI is to parallelize. And what GPUs do is have the CUDA platform or the primitives that enable such computations at scale, right? And the beauty of it is it wasn't even designed with this in mind, right? But GPUs,
right. No, it was this great thing for gaming, right? I mean, I remember the exactly. First time I visited NVIDIA, I talked to the NVIDIA team quite a bit. You know, we use NVIDIA processors locally and on AWS, and, you know, so it's, I remember visiting NVIDIA years ago. It was a fairly small company, and you know, it was gaming, you know, and I wasn't a gamer, but I thought, well, this is amazing, the speed at which things can be done. It made complete sense when the deep learning stuff started happening. And
that's right. And what unifies all these areas together is that mathematical foundation, right, of linear algebra and being able to compute matrix operations and scale. And to me, you know, my research was looking at extending matrices to higher dimensions, which are the tensors. And so I wrote a paper with an NVIDIA researcher back in, I think I would say 2015, Chris Secker. And that was, I would say, the start of that partnership, because, you know, the realization that tensors are not just magical for extracting hidden variables and being able to design good guaranteed algorithms, which I was interested in. But also, on the other hand, in hardware, they're much better to run because there's even higher degree of parallelism with tensors that we don't get with matrices. And so when I started collaborating with Chris and we wrote that first paper, I realized, oh, there has to be this full stack view of what we do with the algorithms and how we design the hardware for it. Right, there has to be now a co-design. You know, you cannot no longer treat them as independent, things, because we are now hitting the limits. Right, we need scale even more than ever. Our algorithms are having higher requirements, and so the hardware design has to incorporate what we are going to use in our computation.
Right. I'm going to go back for 1 second, and it'll lead to tensor, I think. But we talk, 1980s work that people like Hinton and maybe Schmidhuber, people that were doing sort of, there was machine learning in the literature, and it was exciting to some people. You could even say that Minsky was doing machine learning before in some ways, not deep learning networks exactly, but between, if you were to take a paper, you know, one of these fundamental papers, and then you would see what contributions have been made over the last 8 years, for however long you've been, I don't know, 10 years, however long you've been doing this stuff, was this addressed? So neural nets, different layers of, weighted nodes, and all of this were addressed in that earlier work. Is this the main difference now? Is this the main contribution? Is trying to figure out implementation through going, to tensor?
So I would say yes. Many of the ideas were there in place, right? But not the implementation details for sure, and not the data and the compute infrastructure or the GPUs. So I think that was the primary igniting point to start the revolution of deep learning. But then since then, we've seen a lot of advances, right? For instance, generative adversarial networks or GANs to generate realistic looking faces. Again, right, the essence of the ideas is very old. You know, it's there. In fact, you could trace it all the way back to information theory as well with Shannon. The ability to generate new faces that you can fool someone into thinking is a real person, right? That requires, you know, many steps of engineering and also principally grounded methods to make that, right, aspect of engineering. I think sometimes engineering is like a stepchild. It's like, you know, there is the science, there's a concrete theory, right? There's the scientific method, and then everything else, engineering to make it work is a detail that people don't always appreciate. I think what this revolution has shown us is both are important, right? And I've been in both the worlds, and there has to be this healthy dialogue and exchange between the two sides. You know, for instance, the algorithms I've developed in terms of looking at tensors and how you can use tensors for unsupervised learning, right? That comes with theoretical guarantees. But to make it work at scale, right, there's a lot of engineering details, both in terms of hardware implementation, parallelism, but also in terms of, you know, which hyperparameters matter, how do we tune them better. And so when I was at Amazon Web Services before I joined NVIDIA, I helped deploy many of the tensor algorithms into the cloud, especially for topic modeling and categorizing documents at scale. Right. And so seeing that end-to-end picture makes me really appreciate also the engineering effort needed is highly non-trivial. And now in this next decade, I think the most successful AI researchers and engineers are those who can work together.
Do you think that that's going well? I don't mean even in your work. Do you think that there is, you know, I could kind of think of the AI winter as being a kind of divide between science and a lack of commerce to support that science, in a sense, right? And then there was probably just some engineering feats that couldn't be overcome. Is that divide, the institutional divide between tech corporation culture and university research, is it still a division, or is there something more unified now?
Oh, it's so much better, right? In a way, it's like the golden age, because the ability to have dual affiliations like I do at Caltech and at NVIDIA, you know, could not dream of maybe even a decade earlier. I think this AI revolution has upended the rigid model that you can be only in one kind of place or one kind of research area, right? You can either do theory or you go to industry and do all the engineering. I think we are seeing those barriers break down, and hopefully in future, it'll be even more seamless.
Yeah. So let's talk about your big goals. Now, this may be your own work, and I'm sure if you have a big goal, you seem like somebody that goes, if something's interesting, you want to actually get your hands on it yourself. but I see a lot, I've seen the world has generally had expert, we're talking about divisions of academia versus, commercial, but there's also have been traditionally a divide between robotics and artificial intelligence. Those have not always gone together. I mean, you have different regions of the world that have been good at robotics, but not AI, and the reverse. Can you talk about how those two things might be coming together a bit, the physical along with the computational?
Indeed. You know, like the old saying, a healthy mind and a healthy body, right? We have to bring the two together. We call this embodied AI, right? And I think that is critical for us to realize any form of superior intelligence than what we have in our AI systems, because you can only get that by interacting with the world and exploring, right? And right now, most of machine learning is, you know, you have a fixed data set, learn on it, but if that data set has limitations, has bias, there's nothing you can do about it. right? But on the other hand, in an interactive environment, you can go explore, you can go interact, you can even potentially change the environment around you. And that's critical for, you know, the aspect of being able to have a generalizable AI that can do many tasks, that can explore and learn from new data, that can also do unsupervised learning, right? So not necessarily only with supervised or labeled data, but also learn just from unlabeled data.
I don't know that this is what you're saying, because I do get the idea, you know, there's been this labeling problem, and there's an exploration issue that's involved with being able to do unsupervised learning. But physical exploration, when you think of robotics, so we're not just talking about hardware like a GPU versus a CPU, but hardware like arms, you know, and touch and exploring space. That's another dimensionality that, you know, can you explain a little bit how that is just more data? Or, you know, is that just a way to create more data, or is there something fundamentally different with dealing with physical objects versus data alone?
I think it's a lot more challenging.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. And there are so many of those. The primary one is limited data. I mean, you cannot collect a lot of real examples from real world robotics, right? I mean, we are talking about millions and billions that the deep learning methods do, and we can barely even collect tens, or, you know, forget even hundreds, right? And so there is that big divide, and that's where I think unsupervised learning is critical, because, you know, you cannot get a lot of good labeled data, but also, you know, since the real world data is so limited, we have to rely on simulations and domain knowledge. Right. So having high fidelity simulations that can fairly model the world well, but we also need algorithms that can look at domain gaps between the simulation and the real world data and attempt to close that. And hence we can augment our data with simulations and the knowledge of the real world. Right. For instance, you know, we've been flying planes for now, what, a century? And that's now with no AI. Right. So, and if we want to now, you know, add learning to any kind of flight or other robots, we are not going to do from scratch. Right. So we're not going to throw away all the knowledge, all the controllers that are there, but to augment the existing controllers with now learning to further improve. For instance, one of the projects we've done at Caltech has been to show how, you know, when you're looking at drones, and if you look at all the commercial drones right now, they take a long time to land, right? And that's because the aerodynamics is extremely challenging to model. And so the drone is being a very conservative and slowly lands because it doesn't know the model of the aerodynamics. Instead, what we did was to add a machine learned model of this ground effect of aerodynamics, and it drastically improved the speed of landing while still being safe and also being able to do very tight trajectory control, right? So AI is now able to enhance what existing controllers are able to do in robotics. In another recent example at NVIDIA, we've been using simulations to look at legged motion, you know, quadrupeds that walk on all kinds of different surfaces. Can they do that by using simulation data and then transferring that to the real world? So I think there are so many ways to get around the challenges, but that's certainly a much bigger challenge in robotics compared to just standard machine learning.
Yes, I saw the, you know, I've seen videos of the drone landings. And so most of that work, I assume you didn't crash thousands of drones to get this right for your data. So it had to live in a sim, right? So, I mean, it sort of suggests that, or maybe you can tell me if this is true. If a human were there with a remote control, right, and trying to land a drone, it wouldn't be as efficient as the models that you use to land that drone. Is that a limitation of humans being able to create a simulation as well as a lot of data being able to create a simulation with models that you create?
So let me clarify first. In that drone example, so far we haven't used simulation.
Oh, you haven't?
No, the simulation is in this other project at NVIDIA with legged motion that
Okay.
But we did use a lot of domain knowledge because we use the existing controllers. Okay. You know, the PD controllers and PID controllers, they can land, right? So they do a good job landing. It's just that they're very slow. And we want to enhance that further while not losing the safety guarantees, right? And the data we collected was with human operation, like human trying to land well. But then that was in the first project, right? So the machine learning is able to incorporate this knowledge from human landed data. And then in the next project, what we did was to automate that. So can the drone explore itself what it thinks is safe to land? So it kind of progressively lands at much faster velocities while understanding the safety requirements, right? So it comes up with uncertainty bounds and says, oh, you know, I can only increase my speed up to this level because beyond that is unsafe. I don't know what will happen because I don't want to crash. And so what we are giving ability for AI is the uncertainty awareness and the awareness of what is needed for safety.
Right. So I assume on a drone generally, you would have, you know, whether it's some type of, you know, PID controllers or some type of controllers that fall within the sort of range of control theory, something that has existed for a long time. How much of that, so you said you're keeping the controllers, there's still things that are moving, you're keeping information that has been gathered, you know, within whatever range that is. Do you replace the actual control values with it? Does it rewrite the control values along the way?
No, in this project we only corrected it, right? Mm. And in fact, it's an additive correction term because if you're looking at linearizing feedback controllers, then the math works out that you can correct in a very simple way, and that's why, you know, kind of going from fundamental principles of what is the existing controller, you know, what is the unknown force that is introduced because of aerodynamics. And if I learn this, how do I correct for this in my controller, right? So it's end to end, we are thinking of how to go through every step of our current control design and further augment or correct it with learning.
Right. So do you think that this is the... So this seems, say something, you know, in the last couple of weeks, the big, the famous development in sort of generalized AI is GPT-3, right? This is the sort of big deal right now that doesn't seem to encompass the physical in some ways. I don't know if in any ways, but unless you consider understanding what physical reaction is based on, you know, what it has learned. How big of a step do you think that is, and how could it inform being able to create AI that does interact in the physical world?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think before I answer the question, I should first, you know, maybe clarify what I think of GPT-3.
Yeah, right. And maybe even just quickly explain what it is, or, you know,
Sure. So GPT-3 is the latest language model that's the largest so far, right? With about 170 odd billion parameters. And that's a huge jump from the earlier model with, you know, which NVIDIA had called Megatron, that is 8 billion parameters, right? And then I think Microsoft had another one, I forget, right? So you can cut that out. So there is a big leap from the earlier generation of GPT-2 models. And what makes it impressive is, first of all, the engineering feat, right, of being able to train at this enormous scale. And the other is in terms of the data used for this to train it and ultimately look at few shot or zero shot generalization, right? So there's the aspect of like, can you look at now tasks on which it was not available during training data? So I should say this comes with caveats, because given the scale at which it's trained, I think they realized only later on there was a bug and there was some poisoning between the training and the test data. So they couldn't redo it, and they tried to later on try to study the effect. So first of all, we should kind of take it with a hint of salt, because this is not following the a precise scientific principle of zero-shot learning.
Right.
And that's a challenge, right? When you go to that scale, even the aspect of let's retrain this, or let's look at what happens with other parameters, let's do ablation studies, all that is impossibly expensive and that hasn't been done. So that's why I think we should be very careful about what we think this model does, because in some ways it's impressive, but in other ways it's also disturbing. You know, they do look at the sexism and racism embedded in this model. And that's what I think really almost, you know, depresses me, because they spent so much money training on links they got from Reddit, right? Reddit is a toxic place.
Yeah.
And I've been trolled on Reddit. I've gotten threats. I've gotten death threats on Reddit. So a whole thread had to be taken down. You know, there's a long story behind it. And that was when I was fighting for name change of the NeurIPS conference. So I would not go on Reddit, right? And I don't know any woman who does. So you can see that it's...
trained on something that is basically warfare mentality, but rather than based on any type of altruism, which just disappears somehow in internet discourse sometimes.
That's right.
An example of it. And do you consider that's one of the big dangers, actually, is whether it's Reddit or anything, is we have, you know, what they're training on is not control sensors on a, you know, it's very different than what you're talking about. It's not control sensors on a drone. It's not a sim that you're creating for how animals can walk and move, and that, how that could transfer to. Do you think that this is just where data is collected, or how you, you know, this is one of the bigger risks?
I think GPT-3 this way is one of the biggest risks. You know, they've trained this huge model that incorporates all these links from Reddit. And, you know, whatever you can do to filter the worst of those, right, there is just so much innate sexism and racism embedded in them, homophobia, everything you can think of, right? Everybody who's not the dominant white male, you know, trope, everyone else is at a severe risk of getting discriminated by this model. And this is the model now that's available as API for companies to use. And that scares me immensely. So unrelated to this, just on Twitter a couple of days ago, I saw an application called Genderify that's now available, you know, for companies to use to detect gender. First of all, it's problematic because there's only binary gender.
Yeah.
And second of all, it's not just people's names, right? You could input any word and it comes up with an answer of what percentage it thinks male or female. So professor is only 1.9% female or so. So you now are weaponizing words, you know, by assigning them genders. And we don't know how companies could use this, you know, for hiring practices, for all kinds of ways to discriminate against women in this particular case. And more generally, I think with these kind of language models trained on biased data, that discrimination can be completely hidden. And
right, it can, it doesn't even mean malintent by an HR department, that if what they have available to them already contains inherent bias, you know, it keeps reinforcing, because that's training upon what they do, and pretty soon you do maybe have this kind of new, you know, this new system of inequality. I think that this is dangerous right now in a pretty severe way, but something that has kind of gone on maybe for a long time in some ways that are maybe subtle also, you know. I'm curious if you think this is true. Like you know, it's what's wrong with that is if a woman had written, if there was only one person that was coding, or let's say it's a group of women that are coding, you know, and creating the GPT-3 model, as long as they're looking at Reddit, it's the same, whether it's women doing it or men doing it. I mean, it's Reddit is the same. But there is also something that, you know, there are a lot of men, you know, like fairly young white men that are creating, or, you know, are creating models in general. And whether they have bad intent or not, it is something that's always struck me as a little bit worrisome, and because it sort of subtly seeps into our minds that if our technology is created by one type of mm-hmm. person.
I mean, it certainly has a huge impact, right? The lack of diversity and inclusion in our fields has had a severely adverse impact in the kind of AI we create. And it's no coincidence that the AI bias in many cases have been pointed out by women and minorities. For instance, you know, the face recognition APIs that were publicly available by many of the top companies like Amazon, IBM, and so on, the bias present in them was first exposed by female Black researchers, right? Joy Bolonwini, Deb Raji from MIT. So that's important that we have diversity in the field so that there is even the awareness of these problems. I'm sure, you know, most of the men who are writing code to do this never, right? There is such lack of awareness of social context in which it'll be used that they're just, you know, blissfully unaware, but you cannot be in that state, right? None of us can afford to be saying, oh, it doesn't matter, I only focus on science, you know, politics is not something I do, right? I think that is just a severe cop-out. And honestly, that's the enablers are even worse than people who are openly racist or sexist.
Right. And it took, like you said, I think a Black woman or at least a woman to recognize it. You know, there's experiential reasons why, you know, she would recognize it that may not have anything to do with code. And I that's really interesting. I think that plays to something about inclusion and diversity that is different than a kind of pure identity politic kind of inclusion and diversity. It's actually what kind of things that are, even forget the danger, but just the world you want to live in and the creative environment and, you know, how rich our lives are. If we create something that is highly intelligent, perhaps super intelligent, and it is very, you know, one thing, you know, it becomes a very, you may have a world with a lot of super intelligence that is incredibly boring, for one thing.
And I think it'll be dangerous, right? And that's where I think the Silicon Valley culture of move fast, break things, and just focus on, you know, how to exploit people better and right, raise IPOs. I think that whole model is broken. And that also is, you know, making racism, sexism worse, and is a really unhealthy place for women and minorities to exist in tech.
It's possible that Silicon Valley is just a dangerous concept. Like you said, this breaking things can really, you know, imagine if, you know, Manhattan Project were happening and they're like, let's just break it. You know, it's like, if it breaks, you know, we'll learn from it. You know, it's not particular.
I think what's
when you put a different weight on things like this.
That's right. And that's because this impact of Silicon Valley on the whole world on our society, right? It's happened so suddenly, right? Because, you know, we are still in this 80s model of, oh, we write code, we build devices, right? But then now it's able to scale so quickly and information propagates so quickly and it's affecting billions of people so quickly. I think that perspective is not at present.
Well, you know, now that we're talking about safety, it's kind of interesting that the people that are most vocally worried about, I mean, existential risk in the sort of in the big AI existential risk are the same people that are creating the AI or at least funding the AI that you're concerned about. This is clearly, you know, OpenAI has some of these same people, the Elon Musk, and you know, this is and nothing, and like, not that you need to say anything bad about those individuals or anything.
I'd love to.
Okay, yeah, let's do. All right, have at them.
Honestly,
you know, funny enough, when I was telling you I was interviewing Pamela McCordick, I said, well, you know, you've said plenty of bad things about Elon Musk during this thing. I said, I'm taking it you don't like Elon. She goes, let me just tell you, I drive a Toyota. I said, okay. And we left it at that.
Yeah. I think the people who talk about existential threats, but on the other hand, launch highly unsafe and untested AI are hypocrites. And to me, Elon Musk is just a troll, you know, to be honest. It's honestly distorting the conversation around AI because the perspective he is giving the public is a wrong one. You know, right now the Teslas are not tested for safety. You know, AI is not yet ready to be put into self-driving cars, and the claims he's making are simply not true because getting to level 5 autonomy is a long tail. You need to take into account all kinds of scenarios. You know, they may have very small chance, but if billions of people are driving these cars, right, they are non-trivial chances that somebody will encounter. And we are just not there at that point of robustness and safety for AI to be deployed at level 5 autonomy. And so he can say all he wants while at the same time making incoherent remarks about existential threats, which honestly, right, you know, we can worry about it 100 years or later. So when whatever singularity, whatever that means, right, we get
right.
to
he
that.
He won't be proven right or wrong about that, but he will be at about autonomous vehicles.
I think, you know, honestly, this notion of singularity itself is flawed, and I can come get to that in a minute. But I think it's just a position of extreme privilege to be talking about those kind of risks while launching unsafe AI and looking at AI that is racist, sexist, and it's going to have immediate impact on lives of everybody who's not a white male or who's not in a position of privilege.
Well, I really get that. I'm not that you care to hear my opinion. I'm here to hear you. But I think that where I see that there's two sides to Elon Musk and creation and rhetoric and all of these things. I personally don't mind him talking about autonomous vehicles. So because it's an exciting aspirational idea. If you miss your target by a couple years, so what? We want people to try to solve this engineering problem. Now, if you put cars on the road that actually, you know,
exactly.
hit people
exactly.
and hurt them, that's one thing. But hyping something that I would guess that you believe that think that autonomous vehicles are possible. Right, it's not outside the laws of physics or outside the.
But the problem with hype is there is now no accountability, right? And it's only people in a position of power like Elon Musk who can afford to hype, and that prevents, like, you know, scientists and people who are much more conservative and are giving the accurate perspective from being shown in the media. I mean, this is the problem with social media. It's the problem with journalists. They only want to go after hype, and that's a problem with our culture.
I mean, there's hype.
So, yeah,
and there's hype, and then there's push, you know, and then there's inspiration. And those two things can be a little bit different. Whereas the open AI question is one that is a deployed potential danger and that you're looking at, you know, all these things that could also act as inspiration, but only people like you are talking about it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, we see that there's an enormous, they can have this massive amount of parameters and it has this massive amount of power. It's training off of Reddit. There's a danger there. How do we create something? And then that becomes not hype anymore. It's aspirational.
I think there are dangers in many ways, right? I mean, even with Teslas, right, there have been accidents and autopilot is to blame. And I honestly would not drive a Tesla with an autopilot on at 70 miles per hour, but there are others who do. And that is a danger. And that's a danger on the streets today. And I think the rhetoric of level 5 autonomy and all that talk does have an impact of pushing these onto the streets much earlier than they should be.
Is there any work you're doing that you step back and look at and say, if I take it just one more step, it could be dangerous?
I think all of AI, right, has the potential for danger based on the societal context and applications in which it is deployed, right? Like face recognition, you know, on the Siri phone, sure, you know, if I don't have my face recognized, I get annoyed. But if it's in the hands of law enforcement and people are getting arrested mistakenly, and we know during arrest, sometimes there can be a life and death situation, then that's a danger, right? So that's why it's really important to ask how and where is it going to be deployed rather than the technology itself.
Right, right. It's that sort of Richard Feynman thing that, you know, science is the key to heaven or hell, but you don't get to heaven without it. Mm-hmm. And I certainly think that we have to live in that world if we're creating this stuff to, mm-hmm. to think that and then try to figure out where our responsibility is. And yeah, it's, I mean, I think about this, a good example is GANs, as you mentioned. I mean, it's really powerful AI tool that I'm sure you have loads of ideas of how this could be used in positive ways, but deep fakes are created by them, right? And this is, can you give me a really good example of where you think a adversarial network could be used in a positive way?
Yeah, I mean, GANs have so much potential for content generation, right? So one of my friends, Leisha Lee, has the startup called Rosebud.ai that, you know, is trying to create new models of diverse kinds for advertising agencies, right? So that's a great way to not just have traditionally attractive kind of models, but other kinds who could improve what we think of representation. And I think in terms of like being able to train better AI models with synthetic data, right? So we now have simulations, but it's extremely laborious to create simulations, right? And sometimes simulations may be impossible to create because you don't know the underlying model. And that's where GANs or other kinds of generative models could help generate good data for training other downstream tasks. And so I think there are lots of use cases for generative models, and especially controllable generation, right? So if you could now go and control for different kind of lighting conditions, different kind of corruptions, right? So you can now have more safe self-driving cars because it's now adapted to these different weather conditions and lighting conditions that maybe in the real data, no matter how many millions of miles you collected, you may not always encounter them. I think that's the key where generative models can make a big difference.
Right. So the ability to create simulations now has become, you know, it opens up a new world of possibilities because of something like a GAN.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Can you talk about open source a little bit and collaboration? If you could pick great minds and it's 100 great minds that are working on a project together, or you can have 1,000 minds that you don't know working on a project together, how results are produced and what kind of historical or future expectations do you have for that?
Yeah, I think this AI revolution is an open source revolution, right? It's almost unheard of in the previous decades for companies to be launching so many open source code and almost everybody publishing and of making this available. And that's because, right, I think most companies realize that this is not something that is already solved, that you just wrap up into code and commercialize it. But this is a moving needle, right? And it will be for the decades to come because these are such hard problems to solve. And the only way the companies can be at the forefront of this is to continue to innovate and be part of the ecosystem, right? And whoever can be a major player in the ecosystem will be the ultimate winner. And so there is a lot of good incentives to open source and have an open knowledge sharing community, which I think is great.
You think that's AI specific?
I think so, mostly because it's such a hard problem, right? If, say, in case of databases or graphics, or I can go into so many others, right? I mean, you know, it's fairly targeted, right? And it's kind of a lot of it is in terms of how you write robust code and scale it, right? And especially kind of add the secret sauce that makes it work on a specific application. And that's why there isn't an incentive to open source that. On the other hand, right now, the way we are developing AI is still fairly general, right? And that still, in a way, has a long road to go in terms of being able to solve hard problems. And that's the kind of AI that is getting open sourced. Sure, if it's a very specific application and the data available that is proprietary, you don't want to open source it, right? So many times it's the model trained on proprietary data that is not open sourced, but the algorithm itself is open sourced.
So I don't necessarily want, the last thing people want to do is talk right now, probably more about COVID or about, politics or racial tensions. However, I like to think about urgency, you know, when things exit the realm of being theoretical or, you know, certain humans have trouble thinking in long time scales. And, you know, a pandemic, as an example, makes us think about whether we can have a vaccine by next season. You know, this is, so, you know, there's great possibilities in there. And there is, from what I'm, I guess, some risks in there too, of making mistakes if you're doing it quickly. What is there any urgent problem or something that you were working on before that has been accelerated due to current events?
Yeah, that's a good question. In a way, I guess the pandemic has put us all into these virtual meetings, right? So I do miss the in-person brainstorming. But on the other hand, I think the lack of travel to conferences and events, you know, gives me more time to think and brainstorm. And that's been great to have that luxury of, you know, being much more closely working with my team, with my students. So that's been great overall. So I would say in that sense, right now we've really been tackling many different exciting projects. But at the same time, I don't believe in kind of just accelerating, just suddenly there is pandemic. You know, I'm not a virologist. You know, I have talked to people and kind of given them some AI advice who are looking at discovering drugs for COVID or discovering vaccines. But at the same time, I do want to focus on the core machine learning algorithms that we are working on.
Yeah, I for me and for the company that I'm CEO of, people think that I've pivoted a lot to deal with COVID as an example. And I don't think I've so much pivoted. The work is the same. The models we're creating are the same. All these things, but the application is absolutely addressing something that needs to be done. So what you have, I'm going to drop this particular application in order to to work on, you know, creating more robust models to try, you know, to try to do drug discovery. I mean, this has happened.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, in particular, I collaborate with Tom Miller, who's professor in chemistry at Caltech, and he has a startup called Entos. And what we are doing there together is from first principles, what you can do in terms of quantum chemistry, right? Computations for studying molecular forces and using that to later judge the different properties of drugs, right? So, and again, it goes back to building the right foundations, because if we can like now accurately predict the properties of different molecules, then we can quickly go through billions, if not more, number of molecules and decide which ones have drug-like properties. And we've had really exciting results in terms of being able to do zero-shot generalization to much larger molecules than what the training data had. You know, because the challenge is, in order to get these kind of computations using traditional methods, it's extremely time-consuming, right? And you can only do that on smaller molecules. But if we can build the right inductive bias from chemistry in form of what we call molecular orbital features, and then we use the neural networks to learn the mapping from these rough features, coarse features, to fine-grained properties that we are interested in molecules in terms of drug-like properties, then we have the ability to quickly discover new drugs. And that, to me, is exciting.
Yeah, well, which makes me think about going back to hardware in the sense of, you know, chip architecture hardware. So going back to NVIDIA, what is the next great hardware move? Is there other types of neuromorphic chips that that you think are going to be inflection point changing, or do you think about quantum computing and how AI lives on top of quantum computing? Is this something that you've spent any time with?
I think the promise of both quantum computing and neuromorphic computing is interesting, right, in many ways, but still much more in the realm of theoretical possibilities at the moment, right? There have to be some big leaps happening in order to make this practical. In terms of quantum computing, you know, I'm not the expert, but from what I understand, it's this highly noisy computations at the moment, right? And it's not clear how to leverage them to get that quantum leap, if we were to say, from classical computing, right? And that's a big unknown. And it's also so hard to model these noise itself, right? In order for us to say what kind of noise can we overcome, especially for machine learning applications or even quantum simulations, you know, are these quantum computers going to be better than classical ones? That's still an open question, but there's a lot of exciting research happening. And what I think about is more in the realm of these simulations and how we can speed them up on GPUs, right? For now, that's still an important question. And how the role
of... There's still ways to go.
Absolutely. And how the role of tensors plays there, because tensor networks, you know, I've come from the perspective of using that in machine learning and neural networks, but it also has strong relevance in modeling quantum systems, right? And in fact, it started there, the math behind it. And so I've been working with Garner Chan, who is professor of chemistry at Caltech, who looks at these quantum networks from perspective of quantum simulations. And so the computational frameworks that can be built on GPUs can help both areas. And we have a library called QTensor that speeds up the tensor primitives and can enable all these applications. And Tensorly is a high-level API that can help, you know, even novice, right, code developers to write tensor code very easily in Python, in PyTorch, for instance, be able to integrate with neural networks. So I think there's also a lot of good role to be played with engineering, with building good APIs and frameworks to enable these applications.
When we were talking earlier, we spoke about sort of the previous generation of sort of AI innovators from the 1980s and 1990s. But you also work with students that are the, you know, upcoming generation. You're young yourself, but you're a chair professor. And you have the, so, but we, you get to see these. If you look at the dreams and goals of these three generations of that have experienced different things when they came in and different things that they left, have you noticed the difference?
I think certainly there is difference in thinking, right? And again, I don't want to generalize because that's stereotyping people, right? We see.
Okay. Pick an individual of each. You can pick yourself. You get to pick yourself from your generation.
I would say,
you don't
like,
need to say their name.
I would say, you know, in general, certainly younger people are more hopeful for a change, especially when it comes to improving diversity and inclusion and equity in our society in these fields. There is much more awareness in terms of how we can create a healthier environment. There is more openness. And I think, you know, the older generation, they take time to come around, but it's happening. So I think it's really up to the younger generation to lead the way here.
So give me one great, exciting thing that you think you will see in 10 years or 20 years in your career that you hopefully will be a part of creating, that, you know, that's not a faster sim. I mean, you know, I'm not, which will create something else, but what's an end product? What is the thing that you, a world you'd like to live in because of an invention, a creation, scientific research you've done?
Oh, that's a hard one.
Let's say there's 100 of them. You can pick one of them.
Yeah, there are just so many, because to me, the fascinating thing would be AI making scientific discoveries, right, much more autonomously. You know, for instance, right now with this pandemic, right, AI has only played, you know, it's not a center role, right, in the discovery. And that's because, first of all, we don't have all the data in place. We don't have all the engineering in place to enable these drug discovery models to be accurate enough and to help make this quick enough. And so the kind of knowledge to embed, right, with all the existing drugs, all the molecular properties, but also in terms of, right, how the virus itself may be evolving, ultimately be able to predict that. So future pandemics, we can overcome climate change, you know, that's a big issue, right? Can AI provide us creative solutions? I mean, that would be the holy grail. Not at the moment for sure, but in future, can AI take in all the knowledge we have and all the realm of possibilities on how we can move forward and guide us better?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Nima. Is there anything else you'd like that I'm set on a wrong course that you'd like to correct or talk about?
I think we covered great ground. Thanks a lot, Matt. And this was
it means a lot to me. It really means a lot to me that you did this. And, you know, someday let's do get together in person and brainstorm rather than over Zoom, or, you know, invent a better way for us to work remotely.
Absolutely. This was an absolute pleasure.